Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Christopher Rose. For a country slightly larger than the U.S. state of Connecticut, the country of Lebanon has attracted more attention than many other states in the Middle East and North Africa. Ostensibly a secular republic, the Lebanese constitution contains many confessional provisions for different groups and sects, Muslim and Christian, among its very varied population. And as a result, Lebanon has experienced almost a century of conflict since it was first established under a French mandate in the 1920s. But is secularism really to blame for Lebanon's woes? Is sectarianism really to blame for Lebanon's woes? And are these two ideas completely incompatible with one another? These are the questions explored by Mark Farha in his book, Lebanon, The Rise and Fall of a Secular State Under Siege, out in 2019 from Cambridge University Press. Mark Farha is teaching at the University of Zurich in the sociology department. He's also giving a masterclass for Macat.com. I interviewed him about his book and about this fascinating examination, not only of Lebanon's history, but about the way people choose to tell it. Here's our interview. Mark Farha, welcome to the New Books Network. Our traditional first question is always to ask our guests about themselves. So tell us a little more about yourself and your educational background, and what led you to become interested in this topic?
Well, I was born and raised in Switzerland to a parent's father being of Lebanese descent, an American, and my mom being of German descent, as a Swiss, basically, in Switzerland. And I went on to study at Georgetown, where I first became, upon finishing the Swiss school system, where I became interested at Georgetown in, you know, political affairs, international relations, and all that. I got a little bit dismayed with what I saw was the corruption of politics, and then ventured into study of religion at Harvard, comparative religion. And at this time at Harvard, I really benefited, and also Georgetown, of course, I benefited a lot from the free forum of thought that I had there. I could dabble in all kinds of topics and countries. I studied China. I studied Middle East as well, of course. But it wasn't necessarily a foregone conclusion, even though it was partly of Lebanese descent, that I would study the Middle East. And in fact, I only started learning Arabic in graduate school. Went to Egypt for a year, Casa, and improved my Arabic, and then sort of got into that. And then when I started applied or got into the PhD program at Harvard, the original topic was one I was thinking about, looking at comparing the thought of intellectuals in Egypt and Lebanon, secular intellectuals. But then I was kind of encouraged to focus on one country, and so it was Lebanon, which I thought was the more interesting case, because Egypt had been studied a lot. And so I went into that. So, I had a lot of different mentors across my life, from different fields, from different disciplines, from theology, from literature, to history and sociology. And then, you know, I thought that this case of Lebanon would be a very good, example for a lot of these theories and contested theories, etc. So it was kind of not a foregone conclusion, but sort of a natural evolution that I ended up in this topic.
So the book is called Lebanon, The Rise and Fall of a Secular State Under Siege. And this concept of the secular and secularism itself really plays a very important role in your analysis. And you devote a chapter to actually defining what you mean by it, which is actually very interesting because, as you point out, a lot of people make assumptions about what secularism is and what it means. So can we start off by having you tell us a little more about how you understand secularism and why this concept is so differently understood by various politicians, political scientists, historians, and the like?
Yeah, it's a contested history, not just in the Middle East, but also in the European context. And of course, a lot of it has to do with history, the history of the state, etc. In my book, I take a very threadbare minimalistic definition and try to apply that, which is one of non-discrimination. Non-discrimination of the state, neutrality, if you want, towards a plurality of ethnic or religious identities. And of course, there's a tinge of atheism or the accusation, the ready accusation that secularists are atheists, the equation of the two. And that, of course, is very prominent also in the Middle East and the Arab world, amongst Muslims and Christians, I should say, not just amongst Muslims, as some would think. Of course, yeah, in Islamic history, there's a history to this as well. There were people who were called secularists avant la lettre, Nahraniya in early Islam, people that kind of worshipped time, so to speak, or the temporal world. And you have the same in the West with Aurorianism, Ibn Rushd's followers in the West. The philosophers, etc. So there's a history to it in both contexts, and it's always hinges on this kind of question: do you equate secularism with atheism? Need it be oppressive, or can there be a liberal conception of secularism, the civil state? And of course, I always espouse this kind of liberal vision. And I think it's, I have another article where I talk about the gradations of secularism, the Chinese model of the Cultural Revolution or the French Revolution, which is very oppressive. And you have other models, the American model, for instance, which is more freedom of religion than a freedom from religion traditionally. So, these are all the different models. And Lebanon is a distinct case in that it combines all these problematics in a way. There is an element of the Ottoman legacy of the Millet system. There is an element of the French legacy of laicism. There is an element of, if you want, American, if you want to call it that, capitalism, 20th century, and the kind of liberalism that is thought to bring. And it's another question, which I try to raise in the book, is whether capitalist development would lead to secularism or not. This is an old notion. Voltaire used to speak about it when he said, look at the, the stock market where the Jew, the Christian, the Muslim get along. That's a secular kind of society. So the idea that, capitalism and trade would overcome these primordial identities is very prominent, but is also liable to be questioned, are these identities ingrained? And then what is the role of the state to mediate these identities? And Lebanon is really a very good case study to raise these questions, to shed light on these questions. And I was always very disappointed with purely intellectual histories of secularism. Mm-hmm. That is, people that see secularism or the absence thereof or sectarianism as purely a function of ideas. That does not mean, however, on the other hand, that I think that ideas or religious texts can be discarded. They do have an impact on contemporary thought as well. So I'm somewhere in the middle there. You know, there are those that say pure materialists and say it's all about, you know, structural issues and society and that, and others that are primordialists that say it's all about these inherited identities. And I'm in the middle. I try to take account of both. I don't try to deny one or the other. And thus, with this kind of, I hope, balanced and holistic approach, which fuses, and it's ambitious, fuses a sociological, political science, analyses, and historical analyses, straightforward ones, all together to arrive at kind of a better understanding of why secularism or the idea of a secular state gained more traction, or why it receded and was fought or came under siege, as the title of this book indicates.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, speaking personally, as somebody who has always had issues wrapping my head around intangible concepts, I do appreciate the fact that your analysis is rooted in, you know, the historical examples instead of intellectual history has, for its own sake, has always stymied me a little bit, with apologies to any listeners who happen to be intellectual historians, my own advisor being one of those. But you take the approach that we can't really understand the idea of secularism in 20th century Lebanon by looking solely at the modern context. And in fact, you go back to the beginning of the 16th century in chapter two, looking at the Druze prince Fakhreddin II and some of his transsectarian policies as antecedents. So tell us more about this historical approach and what what we can learn about proto-secularism and what we can get out of this long durée analysis.
Well, you know, it's not necessarily my brilliant discovery that and many other historians and intellectual historians too have pointed out, in Europe at least, and I think this applies globally, that the pre-modern phase was a precursor to, you know, what we had later, that the Reformation was a precursor to the French Revolution and later developments, and that in that sense, the, you know, people speak about Machiavelli, for instance, in political science, for the first time kind of creating a division between theology and political science. And you have Calvin, who was, you know, the first fellow to legitimize interest taking, for instance, in Christianity. At the same time that Ebu Sud el-Fendi in the Ottoman Empire, the Sheikh al-Islam, was doing the same. And so I like to look at history globally, universally, and with an eye to the synchronicity across different contexts, which is these common patterns that sometimes emerge across space and time. And you know, that intrigues me and has intrigued others, of course. And so Fakhreddin is one example. You have Emperor Akbar in the Mughal Empire, who has similar reforms. And amongst these reforms were to rule, integrating and giving sort of equal rights, basically, almost, to all the religious communities in one's empire. And that was unusual. And in Lebanese historiography, of course, he's a very contested figure to this day. Mm-hmm. I think unnecessarily so. And I, you know, these polemics, there are a lot of polemics in Lebanese history, and I try best I can to, you know, be objective, and I have no agenda. I have no narrative, quote unquote. I don't like that term necessarily, that I want to push. I have no spin in political science I want to advance. I really just try to look at the facts and the accounts as objectively as possible, maybe more as a Swiss than as a Lebanese participant or whatever. And I found that Fakhreddin, yes, indeed. I mean, whether or not, you know, there's a different debate when you want to say he is the pater patriae, the founder of the nation, in the modern sense, that's a different debate. But you can say, I think, objectively, that he did, in fact, for the first time, you know, allow Shia to serve in the army, for instance, and to, you know, give all the communities basically equal rights, so to speak. And even his own identity was up in dispute, but he presented himself as a Muslim, but he had wives from different faiths and he built churches. And, you know, he was a very cosmopolitan figure. And he did unify a territory which was almost equivalent to today's borders. Now, this is, again, very contested. A lot of people say he was still reporting to the Ottomans, and that is true. But it's also true that the Ottomans severed his head in 1635 and sent an army of 40,000 to, you know, cut him to size because he was, you know, establishing the semi-autonomy in this territory, which was beyond just the traditional Mount Lebanon, but encompassed a huge territory that almost overlaps with that of today. So, you know, the basic predicament is such that you have a diverse society, to make it very simple, of composed of different communal groups and also social groups. It's a feudal society at that point. How do you integrate? How do you rule over that? Do you adopt a position? He was Druze, technically. I mean, mm-hmm. Did he want to have a Druze emirate? Or did he want to have an emirate which integrates all these groups together? And it was practical. I mean, he was a pragmatic fellow. He was, above all, maybe a merchant prince, as they say, a trader. And he, you know, probably for, you know, pragmatic reasons, you can argue, besides ethical reasons, he thought that it was opportune to integrate all these groups in together. Rather. And he also, of course, you know, fought those that were resisting him, but especially feudal lords. But in general, that was the idea. And that is still contested to this day. So, you know, each group, each political faction in Lebanon will look at him differently. And a lot of people will dismiss Fakhreddin as being, you know, it's a historical part of historical mythology, sort of like Wilhelm Tell is in Switzerland. And I think in that case, I think there's some truth to the myth, and also in Fakhreddin's case. So that's what I tried to outline. But it's not my original invention. It's following the footsteps of a lot of historians, also of Europe and other contexts, who point out that the pre-modern pressures of trade, etc., made it imperative that this kind of ruler emerged. And I don't think it's coincidental that you do have similar reforms, patterns of rule across contexts universally in this 16th century.
In terms of the way that this has been described, you discuss in the book a couple of times that, as you said, these histories are contested, which also is not uncommon, especially among countries in the Middle East, as well as throughout the formerly colonized world, where nationalist historiographical ideas have arisen. You describe that there's a school of thought that says that sectarianism didn't exist in Lebanon until the 19th century. And there's another school of thought that argues that secularism is a wholly foreign idea that was introduced to Lebanon during the 19th century, which itself was a very turbulent time. As you just mentioned, Lebanon was not yet an independent polity, but for the region, it was extremely turbulent. You have the Napoleonic invasion of Egypt, then Syria, then the Egyptians invaded and were pushed out by the Ottomans and their allies. And on top of this, the Tanzimat reforms of the Ottoman Empire and the encroachment of European powers, all of which have a huge impact on the community of Mount Lebanon. And this is a key period in the way that people come to think about the area and what its political future should be. So there's an awful lot to unpack here. but can you walk us through some of the major changes that were taking place and how the intelligentsia and the political leadership sought to respond to them?
Yeah, it is a huge question. And I will just maybe try to shed light on some of the maybe new approaches I tried to take. First of all, the notion that secularism is a 19th century invention is not altogether wrong. It depends, again, how you define it. Now, as I said before, if you define it as mere non-discrimination by the central ruler or government, then someone like Fakhreddin would qualify, I think, as a proto-secularist to a degree. But if you define it as in the modern form with the whole state administration and standardization of law and all that comes with that, then it's true that the 19th century, of course, is pivotal. But then also, and this is what I try to show in the book here again by widening the lens, by not just focusing on the Lebanese case and getting tangled in all those debates, which I do as well, but by expanding the lens and casting an eye, for instance, to Europe, because the same Napoleon Bonaparte who crossed the Alps 1797 and unified the growing Swiss cantons the first time in a kind of central state, in a brutal way too, one should say, even though he was formerly Catholic, he raped and pillaged some of the Catholic, his troops did, some of the Catholic regions, and the Catholic, you know, feudal families were less inclined to, or aristocratic families were less inclined to support Napoleon than some of the Protestants were. So it was, in the terms of the sectarian output, it was strange, his legacy. But he unified Switzerland, so to speak, from 1798 to 1803, and then the Act of Mediation as well established the foundation for the modern Swiss Republic, Confederation. He then, as we all know, went to Egypt, right? And there, his program of reform, Napoleonic reform, was also partly instituted for opportunistic reasons. Of course, he opposes Muslim and all that. But in fact, the Christians at that point were welcoming him, according to Djibouti. And his followers, his, as I call it, acolytes, or avatars, came to Lebanon, like Ibrahim Pasha, for instance, and later tried to institute similar reforms. And it's Ibrahim Pasha, for instance, who sets up the first Diwan in Beirut in 1831, where you have the 50-50 Muslim-Christian division. And he even had as the head of the Diwan an Armenian, which was Christian, which was a novel idea then, and very controversial, of course. So that shook up, you know, the whole balance there in the Middle East as well. And again, Ibrahim Pasha, not to lionize these guys too much, was very brutal too in clamping down on other feudal lords and areas. But the idea was, this was a time where the incipient kind of centralization, you know, of Muhammad Ali in Egypt, etc., it's been written about a lot, of the state took place. And this, again, happened, again, to go back to that theme, in parallel, almost at the same time as it did in Europe. And the notion of secularism was also really, you know, started to be debated almost at the same time in the elite circles, in the liberal elite circles in, say, in Switzerland, who were largely Protestant at that time, and in the Beirut and Alexandria and other Middle Eastern cities then as well. So this is the ferment out of which emerges the idea of secularism on an intellectual level, which follows to a degree the political developments. And there you have different debates going on, different grades of secularism, atheism even, all kinds of shades of it. Someone like, I think I go into it, Farah Khantoum, originally from Trablus, and Rashid Rida was also from Trablus. They have, you know, they're kind of the, if you want, the precursors of what we have today of the bona fide secularists, well, not that many, far and few between, but there are a few, and the Islamists, if you want, the Salafists. So that debate was already prefigured there in this period. So it's a formative period, a constitutive period, which has been, you know, written, a lot of ink has been spilled in this period. And a lot of debates still rage about the idea. But just to go back to your initial question, whether it's a foreign implant or not, and this is, of course, still the debate. Well, I mean, as I said before, I think structurally the idea was there already before. But in this, you know, modern sense, yes, of course, a lot of these intellectuals were influenced by European intellectuals, and we know that in the Turkish case as well. They were reading Rousseau and then later Comte and others. And they also suffered sometimes, I would say, from the same deficiencies as their European counterparts did, the highbrow intellectual secularists in some salon. You think of Georges Sedan or others who really had had a real revulsion almost for the common people. And this is an Achilles heel of secularists in the Middle East and in the West too sometimes, which still I think is observable today. I think this elitism, that's the Achilles heel of secularism, that it was, you know, often confined to these elites who were well off, who were could afford these educations, etc., and who were speaking in a condescending way of their compatriots who were still mired in the, you know, religious myths, if you want. And I think that that was a problem, which also appears at the same time. But, you know, again, to say that sectarianism is a child of the 19th century, that I think is you know, I don't find much currency in that argument, because the sectarian conflict was afoot, you know, in the region from time immemorial, both interreligious and intra-religious. You know, you have the Sunni Shia debate, Hurub al-Fitna in the beginning, you have in Christianity many, many schisms, as we know, in historians and Orthodox and Catholics and what have you. And to this day, still, those schisms, some of them prevail in Lebanon. So I think there, we're not doing ourselves as historians a service, and I say this in the book at several junctures, if we try to sugarcoat the past, or if we try to simplistically, you know, lay all the blame for sectarian strife in the 19th century, etc., at the doorsteps of Europe. And that's to the present day. And I'm the last person to ignore the role of European powers and to the present day and Western powers in stoking or exploiting sometimes these sectarian differences. But to say that they're purely a brainchild of the latter, I think, is a gross simplification and does not do a service to the many indigenous voices who valiantly fought and sought to overcome the sectarian blight they had. And this was, of course, the main motivation for secularism. For someone like Bhutto Subbulastani, for instance, who is Nafir Surya, many times makes this argument. He has that precise, if you look at that text, precise ambiguity. It says, on the one hand, yes, the Europeans exploited it and, you know, we're horrible in a way, but on the other hand, it's our fault. And it's really, we have to really look into our own problems. And on the contrary, he even says it's you know, regrettably, that only after 1860, due to the European intervention, was this solved, this problem. And this is a problem that comes up again and again in Lebanese history. You know, the Harub al-Akharin al-Ardna, as Ghassan Twaini used to say, but also al-Asaf al-Shadid, unfortunately, the mediations of these conflicts were often, almost always done also with external mediation, with external influence. And Bhutto Subbulastani alludes to that in 1860 in a wistful tone, but that's what he says.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So you mentioned this tension between the quote unquote of the intelligentsia and others. Can you talk a little bit more about these sorts of social classes and the way that they are differentiated, because you do at various points in the book describe how you have this sort of intellectual set on the coast, and particularly in Beirut. And then you have, the landholders and others in the mountains, and that there's a bit of a tension between them.
Yeah, I mean that is a tension in the mountain and the sea, and also in Switzerland you have that, of course. In other countries, you have this the urban. It should be more the urban
right
centers versus the countryside. And yes, I mean, and then that has, you know, because of the trade networks, etc. The cities were the hub for merchants and for profiteers. And again, that's something, you know, just not to stay mired in history, that extends to the present day to a degree. I mean, that's, and today it's a different form maybe, but you have today in Lebanon, part of the crisis is that the society was so bifurcated between, you know, a financial capitalism, very profitable for banks, and people are speculating with money and that, and the gross majority of the population that was left out of that or is suffering from that, in fact, and paying for that. And it's almost a Marxist view of history, but that certainly also obtained in the 19th century and then came to the fore extremely, in a very vicious way in the First World War, when you had food shortages and people were speculating with grain on the one hand and hoarding grain and getting rich off of that. And others were, one fourth of the population was starving to death. And it's intellectually, I guess I'm guilty of this too, having gone through this kind of education. I was very, very privileged to go through. It's unusual to be able to devote your life so long to reading and to research, and most people don't have the time and luxury to do that. And, you know, sometimes I don't know if it's a luxury or a blessing or a bane, but that's the, you know, that was the situation in extreme sense in the 19th century. And, it was always difficult to find a lingua franca between what in German they called Bildungsbürgertum, the, you know, educated elite, if you want. Mutanawirun, I call them, I think, enlightened ones, so to speak. And the population. How do you make these ideas stick to population at large? And it's still, we can get into that later when we look at the constitution maybe, but it's still the eternal debate of Lebanon, you know, the societal framework, the social profile of the country versus the legalistic text, what they call nufus, that is the souls of the people, and the nusus, the texts. And how do you, a constitution in a sense, as has been said, is kind of a reflection of the spirit of a people. So if the society as itself, say, is a sectarian society, or a confessional one, or a feudal one, or what have you, then how can you paste onto that this kind of constitution? And if even if you introduce a constitution that is quote unquote enlightened, or secular, if you want, and I use those terms with difficulty, then how does it, stick, so to speak? And this has been part of the problem of the Lebanese constitution, which you might get into later, and that it's a hybrid constitution which fuses elements, different elements, some of them drawn from the French constitution, some of them drawn from the Ottoman millet system, etc. So it's, it's not been resolved, and I don't think many intellectuals, maybe poets have been better at that sometimes, but it's difficult to resolve this kind of chasm between elite and society, especially in Lebanon.
Yes, and I did notice the liberal application of verses by Adonis in the book. So, let's turn to the Constitution then, because this makes up quite a bit of the third chapter. The Constitution promulgated in 1926, while Lebanon, which is finally now an independent entity under the French mandate, separate from the rest of Syria, not unanimously agreed upon. I should point out because there was seems to have been a significant part of the population that preferred unity with Syria, and there are provisions for confessional identities written into the constitution. Quotas, certain offices assigned to certain communities. And you describe that this, once again, has often been attributed to the French, but also that you demonstrate that this was a necessary compromise, and I'll quote here, between the secular republican ideal most espoused emotively and the disheartening communal reality that was confronted on the ground. So, and as you mentioned, there's continuing tension over the way that confessionalism has been not only incorporated into politics, but actually proscribed legally, and whether this needs to be reformed. So can we talk more about this, since we've been leading up to this discussion of the Constitution, and how this tension has played out and why finding this balance has been so hard?
Yes. You know, again, I guess I engage in a bit of revisionism here, but again, only upon reading the minutes of the discussions of the Lebanese constitution, which was, yes, under French supervision, but there was a committee of Lebanese who really came up with the draft under the, you know, influence of Michel Shiha and others. And in that discussion, I think I cite the situation where they, I mean, they mix and meld, you know, arguments. Mm-hmm. And they want some bring up Switzerland and Belgium as their ideals. And then others retort and say, well, we're not Switzerland or Belgium, you know.
Right.
And maybe how much they knew the history of Switzerland, which was also quite contentious, of course. But in the end, as only one really member of this committee, Subhi Haider, a Shia actually, who stands up in opposition. All others vote in favor of the confessional safeguards that are introduced in the constitution. So it's not, and it wasn't, that wasn't necessarily a French idea. That was a Lebanese idea and homegrown, because the French were, you know, divided. Some of them wanted, yes, a Maronite state, but others were squarely secularist or laicist. And the constitution itself, as I said before, you know, the first eight kind of articles or so, has many provisions which, you know, are reminiscent of a lot of our Western constitutions about, for instance, freedom of faith is absolute, etc. And Hurriyat al-i'tiqad mutlaq. So that's all there. But the idea was for these groups, I mean, this was the reality on the ground. That's what I'm saying, that you had these confessional identities. And it's still the problem today. I mean, a lot of people are saying, and, you know, why doesn't Lebanon abolish the confessional nature of its aspects of its constitution? And I should say there are a few articles about that there. There's one about the division of the parliament having to be equally divided between Muslims and Christians. So that's there. And there's talk of the fair apportionment of the positions according to confessional representation. But, for instance, the fact that the Lebanese president should be Maronite, etc., and the prime minister Sunni is not in the constitution, just for clarification there. So some of these things, and there, indeed, there were Muslim candidates for president, and, you know, could still be theoretically today. But the idea that you could overnight impose, and some French actually want to do that, a pure French or laicism and superimpose that on Lebanon, you know, would that solve all the issues? There's a lot of aspects of that. One of them is, you know, who would people vote for if the society is based on people, by and large, marry members from the other sect, go to schools mainly, as another say, but from people of the same sect, have this mentality of sectarianism. And, you know, thus, for instance, if you have a Shia Hezbollah member or a fan, he would probably continue to vote for Hezbollah, and the Sunni would continue to vote for Mustafa, and the Christian would continue to vote for, you know, Tayyar or Marada or Falange, the Kataib. So it's really a matter there of realism of sorts. And also, I think, I mean, the other aspect of that, which we'll get into later, is that I hope this book does that, want to reduce all the issues and all the woes of Lebanon to sectarianism, or present secularism as a panacea, pretty simple. I mean, even if all Lebanese were of the same faith, you know, that I keep saying, and, you know, you'd still have, would you have any, you probably have 99% of the current problems as well. So, right. So I don't think, or maybe 70%, whatever, but you'd still have corruption, still have all these other issues, economic doldrums, etc. So I think there's a reductionism there to reduce it all to this. And I think also there's a kind of a, maybe a wishful thinking to say that, if the Constitution could only be rid of these articles that have a confessional aspect to them, then all would be fine and dandy. I think that is also a gross simplification. That having been said, of course, in the, especially after the Ta'af Accord, there are provisions to reform and to establish, you know, a secularization of the system, or deconfessionalization is the word. And that has not been done. So there have been aspects to it. And it's also true that the current system might exacerbate problems. I mean, that's debatable. I don't think it's the cause of all the trouble. And I'm not sure that its abolishment overnight would solve the problem of confessionalism, because if people, as I said before, still vote in confessional blocks, then you still might have the same problems crop up. Whereas the current situation with the electoral laws, etc., forces people, for instance, to vote for members of the other sect, to enter coalitions, and to preserve kind of representation. But I mean, the other problem is, of course, you know, is the representative, say, Nabih Berri of the Shia, does he represent the Shia interests, or does he represent his own pocket of his group? Same with the Christian president, same with the Sunni premier, etc. I mean, should the confessional identity be, you know, determinative of your political representation? So the problem is there, but I hasten to simplify it and reduce it to it.
You actually make a point of not getting into the civil war, so I won't go there. But obviously, that was a major crisis in late 20th century Lebanese history, which came to an end with the Ta'if Accords in 1990. After which, there you describe this push for, again, deconfessionalization in the political sphere, but also accompanied by moves toward privatization and integration of Lebanon into the global economy. But despite this, despite all of the sort of optimism that came in the 90s with the end of the civil war and the sort of revitalization of Beirut and the reopening of the country, you describe Lebanon as an incomplete country. And, you know, we're recording now in summer 2021. The last year has been fairly disastrous for Lebanon on a number of fronts, economic, politically, socially. So why have all these efforts been for naught? Why is Lebanon still, in your words, incomplete?
Well, you know, there's enough blame to go around, and there's a lot of aspects to this, and it's both internal and external. So internally, let's start there. I don't go into this in this book, into the reform efforts, for instance, in education, the attempt at secularization of that. I have a separate article on that. There was that as well. And that effort to unify, you know, the sectarian school curricula and history curricula in particular failed on account of, you know, actually it was in the end of the Fatah al-Islami, the Islamic conquest, that word created a lot of division and polemics. And so that, I mean, there was other reasons too, but that was part of the problem. But there is that. There's the failed civil marriage bill in 1997 under President Harawi, which has made some strides since then, actually. But at that point, too, there was a kind of, even though there was support, actually, for political reasons and sectarian reasons, again, that was brought to fail. Then what you're talking about after 1990, well, there was a state-building effort, right? And in came Rafiq al-Hariri in 93, it's a, and who was a Saudi-Lebanese billionaire who tried to, and again, going back to the notion of capitalism, through development, through tourism, trade, tried to bring Lebanon up from the ashes. And these efforts, you know, were encountered maybe two main, three main difficulties. One is maybe the nature of finance capitalism as a whole, that you create more and more debt. And it was a difficult situation, right? So they had to borrow money on the global markets for and sell Lebanese bonds first for 40, 30%, whatever interest. And that created a huge debt bubble, which increased to the present day astronomically. And now it came, now it was burst. It's a strange wonder, actually, that it didn't burst earlier. People were saying for decades that this should have was not sustainable. And it was not sustainable for, I mean, there's many reasons, compounding factors that came to it. You have the Syrian influence, the Syrian hegemony over Lebanon, and there was a lot of money and corruption extracted during that period until 2005, until, you know, the Syrian troops left after Hariri's assassination. So that was there. But then you have the Israeli impact as well, which can't be forgotten. You have, you know, the Grapes of Wrath in 96. You have... when I first went to Lebanon, I remember the power plant was being bombed by the Israelis. It was later rebuilt with Saudi aid. But, you know, continuous 2006, more recent incident when Israelis responded to the Hezbollah kidnapping issues there. And so it was, you know, that aspect too. Can't be ignored. And there was a lot of destruction and a lot of damage done and a lot of costs incurred. And you add to that all what we're talking about, the identity aspect, which again was compounded by the regional context. The war in Iraq created a refugee wave, as we know, into Syria. That destabilized the situation there a bit. And then later the war in Syria created a huge refugee wave into Lebanon. And today, I mean, I don't have to tell listeners, you know, 2 million or so refugees of Syrian descent, in addition to an Iraqi as well, in addition to the Palestinian refugees camps, which already were there. This all together is such a strain on any state, let alone the state of the confined size of Lebanon, that it's a wonder that the state survived as long as it did. And again, irrespective, I mean, of any identity issues, I mean, though, again, those compounded it, because refugees often, in this case, the Palestinians in the beginning and the Syrians now too, were often of Sunni heritage. And that therefore creates these polemics in Lebanese society about, the sectarian balance as well. But, I don't know. It's a tough answer. Why were all these efforts for naught? I mean, how could it have been avoided? What would have been the better way to get it? There's a lot of blame game here. And it's not easy to see how a country that was completely destroyed in 1990 could have risen from the ashes, given its locale there, you know, sandwiched into between Syria and Israel, and with all the heritage of issues which come with that conflict. And then you have the Iraq war, which again inflames the region and even more. And people forget, for instance, Hassan Nasrallah was the most popular leader across the Arab world before, say, to even among Sunni circles before 2007. But when then the Iraq war got worse and worse, then the sectarian aspect angle got more extreme as well. And what you're talking about before, about a lot of Lebanese wanting to join Syria historically, well, a lot of these used to be, you know, Sunni Lebanese, and it was the Hariri assassination that really, for the first time, really turned, I mean, even before, of course, it was integration, as you say, and a lot of Sunnis were very comfortable with Lebanon, but the Hariri assassination really turned the Sunni streets, so to speak, against Syria. And then the Iraq war compounded these things, etc. So I see it as a gradual escalation, and I see it within, I mean, you can analyze it within the global capitalism angle, as this is a state not unlike, you know, other indebted states, Argentina, etc., who were in this debt trap, and you couldn't get out of that. So you can look at it purely financially. It was almost like a no-win situation. Unless, of course, you look at the Lebanese diaspora and the Gulf money that was pouring in, but that money too dried up with the wars, etc., which have to do with the geographic or the geopolitical situation of Lebanon. So one thing compounds the other, and it's, and again, I don't have a real magic answer of how this could have been avoided. This it sounds very, very pessimistic, but and hindsight is 2020, I guess. But I mean, you know, it is astounding that the Lebanese, with their resilience, could survive this long without any trouble. But now, again, with the geopolitical pressures again heightening, that it seems that the financial load of debt being so excruciating. We're really in a dark situation right now.
So our traditional final question, what are you working on now? What's your next project going to be?
Okay. Yeah, I am currently teaching a class at this semester at the University of Zurich on consumerism, citizenship, and cosmopolitanism. And this is a course I had originally developed in Qatar while teaching at Georgetown there, about this kind of tension between the passive consumer and the active citizen. And, you know, I'm happy to sort of branch out into sociology, so to speak, and to not just, you know, remain focused only on Lebanon or the Middle East. And so I look forward to that. Also teaching a course for a group called Makat Online out of England on the citizen and the individual citizen and the state, and looking at Federalist Papers and Friedrich von Hayek. This is kind of a broad course for a more public audience. And lastly, I'm also kind of dabbling with a dictionary of shared etymological roots of English, Western language words, and German and Arabic and Semitic words. So I have this passion, this private passion about that. That would be kind of a more popular dictionary. Not as dense, I hope, and pedantic as my last book, and we'll see how it goes from there. But I miss the days at Harvard and also Georgetown and Qatar and elsewhere of free intellectual exchange. I think we're entering a phase in history where polemics and polarizations are stifling free debate, and I think that's very unfortunate, and we really need that. And this country like Lebanon needs it all the more. Lebanon was always this kind of hub of free dialogue and discussion and a free press. And it's very unfortunate. A lot of the newspapers, four or five of the major ones, had to shut down in Lebanon. And I think globally, again, we're seeing the kind of the margin of freedom of debate is narrowing everywhere. And it's very unfortunate because we do need that for the liberal state, so to speak, to survive.
The book is Lebanon, The Rise and Fall of a Secular State Under Siege. It's out from Cambridge University Press in 2019. Mark Varha, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next week.